Hello, and welcome to the RichardBarnes.com podcast. The emphasis of the podcast is to show, through others' experiences and insight, a beacon of knowledge, perspective, wit, and warning. A tale of life's lessons, in whatever field. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at richard@richardbarnes.com. Okay, it's time to podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the RichardBarnes.com podcast with my special guest this week and somebody I've been excited about talking to ever since, he agreed to say yes and signed the dotted line. You have signed the dotted line, haven't you?
Well, it's all signed.
Yeah. Okay, signed on the dotted line to say that all proceeds go to the Marley the Dog holiday fund to be taken and by his owner, Richard, to Honolulu. Can I introduce you to Mr. Peter Skillen, martial artist, filmmaker, writer, author, and a coach. What sort of coach are you? Are you one of those short sort of ones with the only six wheels or the big long ones with the eight wheels?
It's Richard. My coaching is basically the martial arts coaching. Try not to go on buses, I get troubles with it.
Oh, really? Well, I see you're actually... Well, I was going to say, you're not that old.
Not that old, no.
So bus passes...
Going on 19.
We're 42?
Yes, 42 going on 19.
So bus passes aren't in your remit yet. But for 42 years, you've done quite a bit, really.
Well, I'm trying, Richard, yeah. I lost a lot of time in the pub. I'm trying to make up for it.
Well, if it's okay, can I talk to you about your chronological order on this spinning blue marble thing? Because you've had some remarkable ups and some remarkable downs. You've been around a few corners and you've learnt some very interesting lessons that could act as a warning or act as an education for other people. And I'd like to explore those, if I may, with you today.
Fire away, Richard, fire away.
Right, 42 years old. Let's go back to the very beginning, because today you are at university, today you are actively learning, today you are actively teaching people, you're a shining light in what you do, you're a well-regarded and well-respected martial artist, and you're going from strength to strength, but it hasn't always been that way. And I wanted to go back to the very, very beginning, because you grew up in a small village-type town.
Well, I grew up in Loughborough, which is situated in between Leicester and Derby.
Yeah.
And, we lived on the estate that was classed as the roughest estate in town. So, it was quite a nice estate for the people that lived there in the beginning, because all very friendly, all real people. But anybody sort of out of that estate were sort of outsiders, I suppose. Yeah.
Was you say it was tough and rough? Loughborough is a small town, I suppose, in the grand scheme of things in the United Kingdom. But it had a certain reputation.
Oh, it had a big reputation, especially in the early 80s and 70s, but I mean, with Leicester City Football Club being, quite a reputable football club back in the 80s and stuff like that, we used to get a lot of football fans dropping off on the way, so there'd always be violence at the weekend. And in the small town where we live back then, there was lots of different estates. And the estates didn't really mix. So if it was a Friday and Saturday night in town, all day even, there used to be quite a lot of trouble, I'd say. Quite a lot of trouble.
How was that for you then, as a kid growing up in that environment?
Well, at first when I was in the earliest memories, they were really quite good, because I had, a big family, a lot of love. It was just normal any... To me, it was just normal. The environment we lived in was normal, But when you start getting older and mixing with other people and going to different schools, you start to realise that where you're living and what you're doing is slightly different.
In what way? Different, you
know? Well, we never had what other people had, material-wise.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I was quite quite mystified about how other sort of families out of our state, they had nice houses, nice cars, you know, the clothes were nice and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And for us, we generally lived, well, I did, being the youngest of the seven. I lived quite a lot on hand-me-downs, clothes-wise. And, you know, we mainly ate stew. And, you know, we was always fed.
Did that bug you at the time?
To a point.
Did that bug you at the time? Right. Were you made aware of it with other kids that you weren't as affluent as they were?
Everybody on my street was in the same boat.
Yeah.
Everybody on my street was in the same boat. You know, it may be with the unemployment rate between the dads and the mothers. Basically, what would happen? You know, somebody would get paid on a Tuesday, and you'd be around there after the tea. Or a few slices of bread to go to school, and then on a Thursday they'd be around you.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? You know, everybody sort of looked after each other in that way.
Yeah. I read an article on you that suggested that up until about the age of 8, you were a happy chappy, a normal kid.
Yeah. Well, I speak about that in my book, in the 12-Step Warrior book. I sort of explain that, like, everything was sort of normal. Lots of love. Lots of, you know, friendship. We all stuck together. But then I had an abuse that happened at an early age then to myself. And at the same time, my father had lost his job. And, you know, bills weren't getting paid and things were getting rougher. And alcohol had come into the equation from the dad's side of things. So, yeah, things started to go on the slide.
So, you know? taking you forward then, you had an early life wake-up call at 8 that coloured your perception of the world. Going through school, how was that?
It was hard, very hard, because I found that because my brothers and sisters who had gone before me we was all taught to have an attitude to stick together, you see, and not to be trodden on. Even though we had nothing, you know, we didn't have a lot. We were still people, weren't we? Everybody, you know, it doesn't matter what you've got materialistically. You're still a person, so you still have to stick up for yourself. It's just that back then, the only way that people knew how to stick up for themselves, so it normally ended up in fighting. So when I arrived at school, my reputation was already preset. I wasn't allowed to be the person who I felt I was inside. I was already tarnished with the same brush, so to speak.
Were you a smart kid? Were you, you know, you're an author now, and you're very creative. You're doing a degree as an adult at school. Were you a smart kid? Was learning easy?
Yeah. I was. My reports always used to say. Could have done better if attendance was better. You know, things like that. But it's really hard when you're a young person going to school and you want to do football but you haven't got the kit. And then you're ridiculed and made to wear the big baggy shorts. And I'm sure a lot of people have seen the film Ted.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that was me, or how I felt. You know what I mean? It was like we couldn't afford the school kit. So we were the ones giving the black trim soles and the shorts that were 10 sizes too big. And for me, that was a punishment for something you couldn't help doing. And it was also, the teachers used to have a tendency to ridicule you a lot about it as well, and rib you about it.
Yeah.
And when it's not your fault, it felt like, now when I look back, it felt like an abuse. And I doubt it would happen now, and if it is, it shouldn't be.
So Did you leave school with qualifications at all?
No, I had no qualifications whatsoever. I left school when I was 15. I didn't used to attend school that much because I had very, very low self-esteem. I had some good friends at school.
Yeah.
Some really good friends that, you know, that would look after me and we'd have a laugh and things like that. But they always seemed to... Well, I used to think that they always were quite posh. But when in reality, they were all quite normal. It's just that we were living on the poverty line. So it seemed to me that they were posh. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'm still good friends with a lot of these lads now. I've re-met them again. And really, they're just normal kids. They didn't know any different. Because, you know, who wouldn't want to provide the best for the kids? I mean, I would want to. And I try to. And that's my main... sort of going back to university, going back and getting some education so I can get a decent job and to provide for my kids.
So you left school, and obviously you left school, and you obviously that you say there you had low self-esteem because of the circumstances that weren't positive for you, having the mickey taken out of you by school teachers when you were in, you know, oversized footy shorts and whatever, all contributed to making school a negative experience. What did you do when you left school at 15 then, with no qualifications?
No qualifications whatsoever. Well, I think, you know, I spent, by the time I was like 14, I'd sniffed glue, tried amphetamine, smoked marijuana, drank lots of alcohol, sniffed petrol, been arrested on skinhead rallies. When I was 13, I walked back from Kenya because I got arrested there at a skinhead rally. And it was...
You walked back from Skegness to Loughborough?
As you touched about it in my book, yeah, I didn't get all the way back, but I still got picked up halfway after I was walking back.
Halfway is 50 miles, Pete. Halfway is about 50 miles.
Yeah, it's about that far, yeah. But, you know, what had happened is we tried to jump a train and got chucked off because we got let out of the cells. I mean, I'm 13 years old. I'm walking around. So I talk about it in my book that I was sort of walking down the street and I was, you know, I had nothing left. I was like praying that somebody had picked me up. And about literally 5 minutes after I'd said this little prayer to myself, you know, I was like, please God, you don't get there before it gets dark because I'm so scared of the dark when I do. A van stopped and picked me up. And the guy inside it turned around to the first thing he said was, "Do you believe in God, son?" And I said, "I do now." And he said, "Well, that's good because I work for the Salvation Army."
All right.
And he says, "Where you going?" I said, "Where you going?" He said, "Go to Loughborough." And he said, "Well, so am I. I'll drop you off."
Wow. You were a skinhead.
Yeah, I'm in that.
You were a skinhead.
Yeah, well, it was like, I think everyone was at that age of skinheads in them days. You know, either skinheads or football trended, football fans, you know, which was, I think it was just about where you lived and what the youth was into at that time. For me, the skinhead thing wasn't anything to do with the racist stuff or anything like that. It was just that I had a family, you know, it was like a second family to me. All my friends that were, you know, were slightly older than me.
Wanting to belong to a group.
Yeah, but they looked after me. I enjoyed the music. I enjoyed it. It was all Scar and Madness. I was brought up on like Trojan Records, all the Scar, my brothers, and that, and Northern Soul, and you know, stuff like that. But then later on in my teens, when all the skinhead scene started to get a little bit racist, and it wasn't for me. I wasn't never in it for that. I was in it for the music and the style, and of course, my friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I sat there one night and watched Shalimar on Top of the Pops doing the moonwalk.
Do you want me to edit this bit out that you've admitted to watching Shalimar?
Oh, I did, yeah. Yeah. In fact, it's what turned me around from in a different fashion. So as soon as I knew that, all I wanted to do was dance.
Yeah.
So the next thing you know, the breakdancing scene exploded, and there we have it. It all changed.
So what did you do for money then after leaving school? You've just talked about trying all these different substances and drugs and whatever. You must have been sourcing money from somewhere.
They're mainly all free.
Yeah.
Because everybody just seemed to have them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it wasn't a big addiction thing. I never went out robbing for money. I'd never been done all that. You know, I wasn't scraping for it and all that. It's just it was just there. And mainly I was hanging about with older people.
Yeah.
So it was just around. I think it was just, you know, something that we all, at that time, tried.
When you first went out drinking, you say that it was a wake-up call for you, that you realised that your family had a certain status.
Yeah, well, my older brothers were took no shit, basically. And because that's just the way it was for them, you know. They took a lot of stick when they were younger, and they were taking no stick when they got older. So it become, when I went out, I knew my brother was tough, and I knew all my brothers were quite tough. And but when I went out into the pubs and the clubs, it sort of reiterated for me how big it was. But it, you know, my older brother John was part. He explains in his book, actually, his thoughts about how him and his gang were around at the time. They were all tough lads. It seemed to me that, like, the whole of the town were tough, like, they were all tough, you know, and it was quite surprising, because what used to happen is they'd all be in a separate group, but as soon as these hooligans and things would come into town, everybody would band together and stick together for the town. Do you know what I mean? It was like,
yeah.
It would all come together, massive fights with football fans and things like that, or whoever it was. And then they would just disband and go their own way, and it would just be back to nodding again. You know what I mean? How are you?
Yeah.
So you had like little different factions. When like the football fans and things like that would come in and try and take over the pub, everyone would just gather together. It's quite crazy, really. Quite tribal.
Yeah. You said about that you loved your dance and you loved your music. You made a few quid doing that.
Well. Not really, but I drank a few beers.
Well, I understand that you and I wore a similar sort of headgear for a little while. I understand that you used to DJ.
Oh yeah, I got into the DJ. Oh, I love the music because I was working as getting off the streets. My brother, who was working on a door at the time, he got me a job at a local nightclub, and I was a glass collector. So from there, you know, from the odd sneaky beer here and there, and then, you know, I used to just hang around the DJ box all the time and ended up DJing. And then later on, I carried on DJing. I wasn't the greatest DJ in the world, but I did loads of stuff, and, I enjoyed it. And I had my nights and loads of dance nights and just the dance music. It was like really... But I think I'd been brought up on the dance music at the time, you know, since I was born.
Yeah.
You know, in the 70s, there was always music. There's one thing that there was in my house, and that was music, always. Yeah. Northern soul, ska, reggae, and then when it moved on to the dance music, you know, the breakdance music, the early hip-hop and the bebop and all that sort of stuff. And then it went on to the rave scene, and then the house music scene. It was fantastic, because I could get lost in it. And while I was DJing, I was in control.
So,
you know, I had a lot of opportunities when I was DJing, but I didn't take them.
Why?
I was too scared of it.
Why? Somebody presented you with an opportunity, you were too scared. Why were you too scared? Is it going back to the self-confidence issue that you described
earlier? Yeah, I used to think to myself, well, you know, I got asked to play at a few clubs and do this, and it was like, yeah, I can go and do it, but what if I'm not very good? What if I get there? It's just fear. What if I get there and I can't do it, or nobody likes me? So I used to pull out, now I'm not doing it. I'd stay safe in the club where I knew we'd be full every week, and I created quite a nice atmosphere there, and, you know, there was, like, over 1,000 people coming every week, and, you know, everybody in the town, the night that I was DJing, everybody in the town would go there. You know, then we started getting guest DJs, it was really good. It was just fantastic. I didn't step out of that because that was my comfort zone.
So were you still drinking and doing drugs and substances at that time?
Drinking a lot. Drinking a hell of a lot. I was never like a big drug addict, but, you know, every so often I'd have a bit of, you know, bit of keep me up, bit of amphetamine. Not all the time, every so often. I never got into the ecstasy scene. I did some acid when I was quite young, some LSD, and it twisted me. But so much that it put me off drugs. Not something I'd recommend for anybody, Richard, but, you know, it sort of did the trick for me. And plus, you know, and I was seeing how far down other people were going. I'd known for years. And they were going down the slope and then getting into heroin and cocaine. And I was looking at them and thinking, you look terrible. But I forgot to look in the mirror at myself because I was drinking so much beer that I was looking terrible and old. Do you know what I mean? But I was very good at hiding it.
So at what point then did you stop being a good DJ and start being a good alcoholic?
I think they both went hand in hand. You know, but it got to a stage where my drinking took over my life so much that I forgot about my family.
You were married at this point? You were married and had
married,
kids?
No, I've never been married.
Okay.
Married. But I'd met a lovely girl when I was younger. We were both very young. I had two beautiful children, but I failed to be a good father.
Okay.
So it ended up, you know, we split up, and I've become a Saturday dad, and that was that, really. You know, I kept seeing my kids, but I'd go around there drunk at all hours of the morning, and, you know, everything was everybody else's fault, nothing was my fault, and I mean, I know differently now, but in fact, everything was my fault.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was all my choices that I made. Okay, I might have felt like I had all this angst and anger from when I was a kid and stuff like that. But instead of trying to change it, and then, you know, back then, I didn't. What I did is I went with it. I did totally the wrong thing. I'd become what I hated the most about my childhood was my dad being a big drinker. And he's a lovely man. You know what I mean? At heart, it was lost. And, you know, he'd shout a lot of things like, he's never hit us, never ever hit us or anything like that. And I knew he was a good man in his heart, but he was just lost to alcohol. And I hated him for it, and I hated the alcohol for it. But I'd become what I feared the most and hated the most.
What was the straw that broke the camel's back then? When did you tip from being somebody that was earning a few quid and getting out there enjoying to realising actually, you know, you are an alcoholic, you're out of control, you're not there for your kids. What was that wave-breaking moment?
Well, I think I knew that it was going wrong from an early age, but I just didn't know how to change it, and I didn't even think about changing it. I thought, this is my lot, and that's it. So, it came to a point when I was lying in my room in the bedsit that I had, and there was nothing in there, just me and a mattress.
Yeah.
And I'd sold my record collection for pittance. I was scraping around for beer money. And, you know, I'd stopped doing my martial arts as much as I should have. Well, you know, I wasn't doing any martial arts for a couple of years.
So you've been training in martial arts at this point? I always
kept my hand in with the kickboxing I was doing and, you know, fight training with my brothers and stuff. But it was all about fighting. It wasn't really about anything else that it should be about. You know, it's like, for me, martial arts, whether traditional or whether any kind of boxing training, kickboxing training, kung fu, you know, tai chi, any of the arts for me, now I realise and look back on it and I've learned from it, is it's about change, isn't it? It's all about change and progression.
Well, I read that you said that at your lowest point you decided that ending it would be easier than trying to come back from it.
Yeah, definitely. I was so lost and so down and depressed that I thought if I went out of the country, you know, I could leave it all behind. But what I forgot about is that when you do that, and in, you know, the circles that I'm in now, we call that geographical, trying to move away from your problem. But if you're the problem, you take your problems with you, don't you?
Mm.
So then when I got out to being abroad, I sat on a beach one day with a bottle of vodka, and I just wanted to kill myself, yeah.
So...
And then it was at that point that I sort of had my kids going around in my head and my family. And I just thought, you know what I mean? You've got to make a choice. It's either one thing or the other.
Is that your moment? Is that as you? I've heard you use this phrase before in conversations with you. Was that your moment of clarity?
One of them. I don't think I was completely clear what I was going to do. I just knew that I couldn't be there and I had to get rid of the beer. You know what I mean? I had to, because I was going to die on that day. I knew 100% that if I stayed there a moment longer, that was it. It was over. You know, I've just made a film, just shot a film in a cinema with a guy called... Paul Morrison and a director called Natalie Smith, and it's all based around that situation and life previous to that, and how people think when they're, you know, I spoke to a couple of people about when they've been depressed, they've been on the edge of suicide and things like that, and it all seems they all have the same sort of moment. You know, some people call it a moment of clarity, but I just call it a moment of change for me. Because my moment of clarity didn't come until years later.
How did you go about using this moment of change and turning this thought into action? What did you do?
Well, I got home, and I had a girlfriend at the time, and she pointed me to a rehab. Basically, she saved my life, you know, which I'm ever thankful for. And I went to the rehab, and they sort of offered me a place almost immediately. And when they did it, I was so desperate, so at an end, you know what I mean? It's like, I can't go on like this. It's, you know what I mean? I needed things. I had to. Because if I didn't, there was nothing. I couldn't see any further than the next hour if I didn't get some sort of help. So when I went into this rehab, it wasn't like I'd failed. I did feel like I failed in my whole life, as a father, as any job I'd ever done, as a person. I thought my whole life I'd failed. So at this point, when I went into this rehab, the first thing I did is I was put into a bedroom, which was quite nice, and I sat on the bed, and there was a St. James's Bible next to the bed. I picked that up and I looked at it, and one of the things it said in it was, what use is the word to a man who's known his own soul? And at that point, I thought, oh, I'm in the right place. And I stubbed my heart out, and it was like the whole world had been lifted off my shoulders.
How long did it take from that moment then to feeling, well, you obviously gained a little bit of self-sovereignty at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But how long before that acquisition of sovereignty for yourself actually turned into positive action to where, you know, you became able to function again out in the real world?
Oh, I spent rehab about 10 months or something like that in there, long time in there anyway. Every day I was being stripped away. But what I didn't realise is why they were stripping me away, they were permits built back up. I was being taught that we get up in the morning, so we can clean the house, have breakfast. Just normal things that normal people do that have become abnormal to me and to other lads and ladies that were in this place. But by them giving us routines and making us, you know, do things like normal things like cook our own breakfast for each other, start to share things, and, you know, in the mornings we'd have a group of AA where we discuss our problems and things like this with counselors. Yeah, and then in the afternoons we might have an art workshop.
So AA, you were talking about Alcoholics Anonymous?
Sorry, AA is Alcoholics Anonymous, yeah. Okay. I've become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous as soon as I went in the place.
So ten months, you come out, you've...
Well, I came back actually after about 4 months, and I came out into the world, and I realised that nobody really cared. My family, yeah, they cared, everybody cared, but nobody really bothered, because after all, to them, you're just a drunk. You know what I mean? What's up with you? You've only had a few drinks, that sort of attitude. And I didn't get it, because I thought, well, I'm really down and desperate. Don't you see it? Don't you see how, you know, what's happened to me? And people were like, well, no. I mean, why should they? They've got their own problems, their own life to live, haven't they? It's like, when you're drinking and you're depressed and these problems, you think you're the centre of the universe. And you're not. The world's going to go on without you, whether you die tomorrow or not, isn't it? Everybody's going to carry on. You're going to get over it and you're going to carry on. So I just didn't understand it, and I hadn't learned enough about myself, and I was sort of had a dry drunk syndrome where I wasn't drinking, but I was still living the same, trying to live the same sort of pattern of life, and it didn't work. It didn't work at all. So I phoned up the rehab and asked if I could go back, and they said, yeah, come back. So I went back. I hadn't had a drink, and I went back. And when I got back there, there was a new set of people, you know, all the friends that I'd made had gone. And they were horrible to me. They were like, whereas before I'd made some friends, we'd have a bit of a giggle here and, you know, in between doing the work we'd do and all that. But it's become now like I was the outsider of the group. And I felt like the outsider of the group. And I hated it. Yeah. So what happened then is I was trying to work out why I was the outsider, why I was this, why I was that. Over the months, you know, still going to meetings, still going to the classes and still learning about myself, reading a lot of books and things like that. And it wasn't until 3 or 4 months later that I realised I felt different because I was different. Because yeah. they were where I was, and I'd gone up a level.
Right.
In, you know, becoming more sane. And when I spoke to my counsellor about it, I told him, I said, you know, why do, you know, they're all mad. And he goes, yeah, you were too, but you're not now. And that's when I sort of realised, I had a big epiphany a day or so later, sat on a golf course, and I just realised, well, yeah, you stopped drinking and you started living differently. But now you've got to go out in the world and you know, take it into action, so to speak.
Since then, can I ask, were you continue with your martial arts through this experience, or was that something that was put on the shelf?
Oh, no, when I was in rehab, I joined a small club down there, and I used to go down once a week. And got my hand back in, you know, doing a bit of training. You had a punch bag at the rehab and things like that. So, you know, as soon as I come out, I embraced it all again. Well, it wasn't straight away. I went back to to the gym and things like that, and just practicing what I knew and what I'd learned over the years. And but it come to a point where I where something was missing, because I was just, you know, living my life, and something was missing. And I realised what was missing was the martial arts.
Yeah.
Because, it, you know, I think if it wasn't for the martial arts through the drinking years as well,
yeah,
I would have been dead a lot earlier. Do you know what I mean? Because that was like my only focus. And I should have been focusing on other things, obviously. I wasn't, but I always made sure I tried to get to my classes and do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was very weird.
That was your redemption. That was what was kind of your. Do you think it was a redemption, or do you think it was something that stopped the inevitable happening earlier? If you get what I'm saying.
Which bit?
Well, had all the way along, you've had martial arts in your background, and you've been training and whatever. Even at your lowest point, you've been going out and doing a bit. And it's kind of been redeemed yourself. It's given you that inner strength to fight against the adversity that you were facing. Now,
without doubt.
But you don't feel, you don't hold a grudge against doing that now. Because had you not done that, perhaps the moment of clarity or your low point may have come earlier. Because if you...
I understand what people say. You have to get to your low point before you realise that you've got to turn it all around. But no, I don't think it did. I think it was what saved me.
It's always been a friend in your life.
My martial arts?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Because if I wouldn't have had, you know... the classes and all that, and people in the martial arts to sort of fall back on and be with, I would have been more desperate, and I think I would have met death earlier. I don't think I would have been saved early, because, like you said, it was the martial arts training and the people in the martial arts that sort of used to pull me back. You know, they used to say, "What are you doing, kid? You know, what are you doing?" And going there with people and seeing what they were doing. And you know, our clubs, the clubs that I attended, the Buddhist clubs, Buddhist Sam and John, it was our training. It wasn't no patterns, no forms and all that. Not that there's nothing wrong with that. I think they're fantastic. And I'm always in awe of people that do these, you know, the patterns and all these things. It amazes me. But it just wasn't my thing. Maybe, you know, that's something that I should look into, because I really am in awe when I see, you know, these fantastic point fighters and fantastic displays and martial arts displays. I mean, some kids out there in these extreme martial arts are just astounding, isn't there? And it's all done through hard work and dedication.
Yeah.
I mean, some people say, "Oh, that's not going to save your life." It might not save your life on the street when there's a fight going on. If you've got any brains about you, You won't be in the street fighting, would you? You'd be at the martial arts club, practicing your moves, winning trophies, and, you know, building your self-esteem.
After you left,
instructors out there that are helping kids all over this country, all over the world.
Yeah. After you left, you know what I mean? John. After you left your rehab. And you discovered you are a new person by accident, really, by going back into rehab and realising actually the guys that are there now were you some number of months ago, and that you are a different person. As you built and moved away from that, you described it as a lower level and became a higher level. How did your personal relationships with people improve?
They didn't at first. I became... a bit of a recluse. I was still learning, and still learning now. You know what I mean? It's not a thing that you go boom and you change. What you've got is you've got a toolbox. You've been given a toolbox for the job. You know, you've got steps in AA. You've got 12 steps in AA that are your toolbox. So when you get a problem, you don't fight it with what you used to fight it. In fact, you don't fight it at all. You just let it go. You know, or you tackle it in a productive way. there's no point of being angry at it, holding any malice against it, thoughts of revenge. There's nothing. It's all dark stuff.
How long ago was it that you became the new John, the new improved John?
John?
Sorry, how long ago? I always do this for you and your brother.
You're getting confused with that, aren't you?
How long ago was
it? Can we start again and edit that bit? He's always getting my airtime.
Hang on a minute. I'm not talking to John. How long ago? Actually, look. This, I tell you why I said John. I've got something in front of me at the moment. I posted on Twitter earlier on that I'm going to be chatting to you, and a certain John asked me to ask you if physical training and martial arts help him in his daily battle, and if so, how. Now, that was a great question, which kind of I was going to say thank you to John for, because that was the line of question and I just asked you. So I do apologise for calling you John when your name's Bob.
Oh, no. Hey, listen, I have a brother called John.
Yeah.
And he's one of the greatest people you'll ever meet in your life. He's a guide, a guided light, a fantastic instructor, martial artist. So you can call me John, because that's for me is only a compliment.
All right.
There's no problem.
That's not the first time I've done that. But there was a valid reason for that, Pete, at that point. Honestly, I wasn't, you know, at the end of the day, I'm only male and I can only do one thing at one time, unless the other thing involves scratching. Now, the question was, okay, the new improved Pete came about, right? How long ago was it that the new improved Pete came about? Because you said you're a 42-year-old young fella now, going on 19. How long ago was this that the new Pete had started to, you know, hit the scene? Not as you are now, because I understand it's been a long process to get to the mindset and the view and outlook you have now. But how long ago was it?
I can't tell you. I don't know, because it's not for me to say I am the new Pete. It's, you know, other people tell me that I've changed, I'm a different person. You know, I still have massive problems. I still, you know, I've been through a lot of adversity recently, and, you know, things happen in your life that shouldn't happen that way, but do. But it's how I attack those problems and that adversity now. Do I go out fighting about it? Do I go out, you know, ruining other people's lives about it? Do I go out drinking? No, I don't. I can't. Because that would only bring wreck and ruin to other people's lives. So what I have to do is take control of the problem myself, own the problem, deal with the problem, and then move through it. If other people want to say I've changed, I can only thank them for that. I can't turn around and say, ooh, look at me, I've changed, because I don't do that. You know, it feels kind of weird to me when I get messages off a lot of people that have read my book and listened to podcasts and read interviews that they are really inspiring, and it's fantastic that, you know, I've had letters that have made me cry because the people have said, because of what I've read in your book or listened to or read on one of your articles, or what you're achieving, it's allowed me to do that. Now, in a way, I don't know, you know, I sort of think to myself, you know, I get the old doubt, who am I to do that to other people? But then I also get the same thought, I also encounter acting for it, who am I not to do that for other people? But I can't go around telling people what to do. All I can do is say what I've done.
Well, let's talk about what you've done then of late, because from this truly truly remarkable triumph of human spirit, that's how I described you on Twitter, because, you know, you have been through the grinder, you have faced adversity, and you have had a moment of clarity, made a decision that, you know, I'm not going to take the easy way out, enough is enough. I have responsibilities. I have important people in my life that I want to be there for.
Mm-hmm.
You have done so. You've gone from that and being, well, you know, in a shit place and being a not nice person to somebody that now has a book out that's taken himself and taking yourself and put you in university to study film. Well, I mean, that's no easy feat, because you'll be in and amongst people, you know, significantly younger than you that will be looking at you as an outsider. But where you were scared of being an outsider before, that's not something that allows you to rule your life anymore.
No, well, that's a good point, actually, because actually when I went back to college, when I first went to college, I took some scripts that I wrote and all this, because I wanted to say, look, I'm interested in writing, I want to make films. That's always something I dreamt of when I was a boy, always lost in films, always. So I went and met the tutors and I said, I've got no education, but this is what I want to do. And I found that they loved it. They loved the fact that I just wanted to do it. So people out there that are thinking, oh, I don't like to go to college. Oh, I was talking to a young lad about, he was saying he wants to be an actor, but he can't do it because maybe his friends will think he's an idiot. Because he's 19. Especially around the town with the lads, isn't it? That's what he thinks. And I said to him, look, mate, just go and do it. If your friends really are your friends, they'll support you. And they'll say, yeah, go do it. They won't turn around and take the rib out of you. But if they do, it's just banter. It'll fall away. But if you're surrounded by people like that, get rid of them. You don't need people around that like that in your life. I try not to mix with people, but people are saying to me, oh, who do you think you are to write a book? Oh, who do you think you are? Pretty thing said. Who do you think you are making films? Oh, ooh, you're a big man now and things like that. Bye. It's that simple. Don't mix with them. Mix with the people that turn around. I've got friends now that I talk to, especially my college family, that, these kids, the younger children, because young adults, these people I'm at college with in my class, so to speak, they're amazing. They inspire me every day because they're 19 and they're doing it. They're 20 and they're doing it. And they know what they want, and they're going for it. And not all of them are, have this, that, and the other. They've all got, they come from families that have had problems and things like this. But they're going to college and go to university, and they're 20 years old. They've got a massively fantastic creative life in front of them. And do you know why? Because they don't care what anybody else thinks about them. They just go and do it. In a positive way, I mean. I was so scared of going back to college. It was unbelievable. I'm going to be the old man and this and the other. But when I got there, it was fantastic. It was like having another moment of clarity. It was like sitting in that rehab bedroom again and go, wow, here we go. So I went, I had no qualifications. So I started with a BTEC. So I turned up, I did the work, and I got a triple distinction. And I thought, I like this, I'm going to carry on. So I signed up for the HND and I went for another 2 years and I got a distinction from HND. And then I signed up for the BSc and I'm doing it and I'm 3 months in and I'm going to get a first. There's no other way to think.
It's ironic,
I'm doing everything.
I like that story. I like that story because it reminds me of a similar story with myself. Because I went back to education as well as a mature student. And I remember I went and did a law degree, and I remember sitting in front of in one of these classes where everybody that signed up, go along, pick up your books, reading list and whatever else, and had one of these introductory sessions. Now, as I've displayed in this podcast, me and names and remembering names aren't one of my strong points, John. But... the worst game, worst ice breaking game you can play with me that puts more fear into me than anything else is one of those games where you sit around a table and somebody says their name and says something about themselves, then the next person has to say the name of the person to their right. And then, you know, you're 8 or 9 people down and you're having to try. Well, I was like 8th or 9th down and I'd forgotten the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th person. I was having trouble remembering my own name at that point.
I'm exactly the same.
Oh, yeah. God. Well, the thing was, I was sitting in that room and I felt unworthy to be there. I was thinking, all these people are cleverer than me. They were all mature students. A lot of them had, you know, I was a DJ and I was a civil servant at that point. And I was thinking, these people work in solicitors' offices, they're police, they've got legal backgrounds, they're doing whatever.
Everybody's better than me.
Every single person there is worthy of being in that room apart from me.
And, yeah, I know. That's how I felt.
And to be honest with you, I nearly walked. What didn't make me walk, I think, was the fact that I would have to have passed 7 people and asked them to move because I was up in a corner. And that would have been even more embarrassing than actually, you know, trying to walk and get out. At the end of the course, it took me 5 years to complete the degree part-time. Law is one of the longest courses. Law and medicine are the longest courses. And doing them part-time, it's even, you know, it even drags out even further. It took me 5 years. 5 years, of the 40 people that sat in the room, 3 of us finished the degree.
Yeah, unbelievable.
3. And it gave me, it was a wake-up call on worthiness. And also what, you know, hard work and determination and grit. And to hear you say that story reminds me of that as well. You've written down a lot of your experiences to date in your book that's doing very nicely on Amazon. There's some fantastic reviews, including one from Little Miss Moffat. Read this sitting on a tuffet or whatever. I've never read a book that has taken me on such an emotional roller coaster quite as much as The 12-Step Warrior. Tears, heartbreak, a giggle, a very brilliant insult, and finally, an overwhelming awe of Pete. Your book is getting fabulous results and reviews, and is helping a lot of people. You must take pleasure in that.
I'm very proud of it, but you know, I spoke about this before. I still get that. You know, I go into the Waterstones yesterday and, you know, arrange a book signing and the big fear starts again. Oh, who am I to do book signing? You know what I mean? Who am I? Why do people want to come and see me and get a book signed? But it's happening all the time. People are ringing me and messaging me and can you sign my book? And, you know, nice messages of support. And I mean, I've been shown so much love from people I don't even know. It's unbelievable. But it's like, you know, we have these fears, don't we, of who am I to be this, who am I to be that. And I get them, but then I just go, well, I'll do it anyway and see what happens. It doesn't matter. If nobody turns up, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, because why would it matter? It doesn't matter.
Well, the thing is, if nobody turns up,
what if one person turns up? What if one person turns up?
Yeah.
And I have a chat with him or her, and it enables them to change their life. Then the job's done, isn't it?
Well, the other way of looking at it, if nobody turns up, you're going to be the best looking bloke in the room.
Hopefully.
You've continued with your martial arts.
I'm back to doing a lot of martial arts.
You're doing your street tough self-defense. You've got your psmac.co.uk websites where people can find out loads more about what you're doing in the teaching so they can get in touch with you.
What's happened is I actually stopped teaching in January of this year because I was going through a bit of turmoil in life at that moment. And I had to do something that was it was termed by some people as selfish, but actually it wasn't. It was selfless because I had to look after myself. I couldn't stand in a room and teach other people to be a certain way and, you know, and to be positive and do this and do that when I was going through such a hard time myself. So I stopped it. And people mentioned, are you going to do some more? Are you going to do this? Are you going to do that? I said, not until I'm right in myself, until I feel that I'm back at the point where I'm worthy of teaching. Now, a lot of people tell me, yeah, you are, you know, I've been to seminars with some very good people and taught at their classes and stuff, and I've got nothing but fantastic feedback. But I think what I sort of have to do is, I mean, I've gone back to the bottom of the ladder. Not that I was ever at the top, but I've gone back to being a white belt under an instructor called Nathan Beebe, who's a black belt, a jiu-jitsu instructor. And I'm just teaching, I'm just learning so much about myself again. It's unbelievable. You know, I go to my brother's gym, John Spillane's Martial Arts and Fitness. I forget that incident.
Yeah, now he's asking a question. Has he had a name check already?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, we call it the Palace of Positivity. Because when you walk in there, that's what it's full of. You know what I mean? And he helps me a lot, gives me a lot of guidance. You know, I sort of go to him. He's definitely one of my mentors, along with Jeff Thompson. He's another great mentor for me. And some other people, you know, that I just talk to, other martial artists. I get inspired and to carry on by other martial artists. You know, I see what they're doing. And it inspires me to do mine. And I've got my very best friend, Eamon, who's in my book. I've known him since I was 5 years old. This guy has been through adversity on a massive scale. You wouldn't believe what he's been through. And now he's like, blue belt jiu-jitsu. And it's his life. And he trains every day and he does this. And if you knew what he'd been through, I'm trying to persuade him to get his own story out there. So hopefully I'll be able to do that and help him with that, because, you know, he inspired me so, so much. It's unbelievable. You know what I mean? I look at what he's been through, I look at where he is now, and it's what keeps me going.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But like I was saying about the teaching of things, I am going to teach them, but I have to make sure that everything is slotted into place in my own life before I can pass anything on. Do you understand where I'm coming from?
I do, yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, look, for instance, the way it's me putting on, I don't know, becoming from the 11th stone I am to 15th stone and then going to teaching a diet class.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If I'm going to teach people martial arts, which for me is the ultimate in change. For me, martial arts, no matter what art it is, it's about change. Why else would we have belts? It's not about money, is it? It's not about fighting. It's not about how tough you are. It's about progressing from one stage to another stage, which is better than the previous stage.
I want to ask you one more question. Before I do, I had a message for a shout-out. To wish happy birthday to Paul Ricketts from his lovely lady Samantha Hallam. So happy birthday, Paul. It's probably a few days afterwards.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, me and Pete thought about getting you a present, but we decided not to. But after all, it's the thought that counts. Isn't that right, mate?
We did put that five in the envelope, but didn't we
seal
the envelope before we
called
it something?
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
It was. I think there was money involved, but I'm not sure what happened to it. Right. Although you've said that...
As long as it didn't go down the pub, Richard, we're all right.
I haven't been down with them for a long time, but maybe a packet of dry roasted, that'll do me. Final question, and this is I've asked this on the previous two podcasts of my guests. And I know you've said that you don't feel like it's a new you or a different you. It's just an evolution of you. But I'd like to take you today and stick you in my time machine and stick you in front of a 15-year-old Pete so you could have a quick chat with him. What one little bit of guidance or advice would you give?
Follow your dream.
Pete Skirlin, it has been a pleasure and a privilege to chat to you today. Thank you for sharing your candid and honest opinions with us. 12 Step Warrior is available through Amazon. It's a bloody good read. It's got fantastic reviews. I've got to get my copy signed, so I may turn up at somebody's book signing. So I may be just the only one that turns up. And if I am, on over.
I'd still be the best looking man in the room.
You knew where I was going with that. Thanks, Pete.
I licked your lines, Richard. I licked your lines.
Thanks very much, Pete. I wish you well.
Take care.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.